This is Virginia Voice Program Director Teresa Ray, welcoming you to Voices from the Mighty Pen. Virginia Voice is proud to bring you this program in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial Foundation's Mighty Pen Project. The Mighty Pen Project is a free writing course for veterans, helping create, preserve, share, and honor their stories for us all. In this series, you'll hear stories written by Richmond area veterans through the Mighty Pen Project, then read by the authors in our Virginia Voice studios. This program recounts the experiences of veterans who served in active duty and may describe scenes of combat. Listener discretion is advised, particularly for those who live with PTSD. These stories may contain graphic language, graphic accounts of violence, and other potentially triggering content. Now, Virginia War Memorial Foundation and Virginia Voice present Voices from the Mighty Pen.
Kyle, let's talk. Just a couple things hit me. What I really would like to know, though, is how did the Mighty Pen Project help you tell your story in words?
You know, the biggest part of the Mighty Pen so far, well, first of all, has been working with David and the other people that attend the class as well. It's a really incredible group of people that, you know, I have my own writing style, I guess, if you would say, mm-hmm. my own language that I write with, but it's been really great hearing everybody else's writing language and then hearing David break it down into, you know, the what he calls the manipulatable pieces of writing that you can use to create something. And it's just been really neat to see like that kind of science side of it combined with the artist side of each individual and how they would use their own words to do it. And, you know, for me, I think the biggest thing is focusing on the point of view. You know, I find myself so often trying to just write to explain things, but, you know, so far the Mighty Pen has really helped me understand what point of view you're writing from in order to create the human experience that you want the reader to relate with through your writing. And I guess I'd say that's probably been the biggest thing I've learned from it so far.
Because you have your own style, and David helped refine it, apparently. David Robbins.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, David's been great, but also just everyone else in the class as well. You know, David always says in the class he does most of his teaching on the page, and that's what we do with pretty much the entire class is people write each week, submit their writings, and we spend most of the class going over the writing. So it's pretty neat not only to hear from David, you know, his take on what good writing looks like, but also hearing examples from other people and learning about why things worked, why things didn't work, and how I might take those things and include them with my own writing.
You're about to read your story, Lego, The Lego Master, and in it you say you were discharged in California from the Marines and moved to Pennsylvania, moved to Wisconsin. What brings you to Virginia?
Well, just like pretty much all my other moves, it was a job that brought me here. So I'm still working with the same company I worked with in Wisconsin. Just we were building a new plant here in Chester, Virginia.
Which of the many places do you like?
Definitely Virginia the best.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Where are you from?
I'm originally from Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So
talk about Midwest. I mean,
right. I mean, we loved California. I don't know that I'd want to live out there with my kids and everything now.
I hear you.
But, yeah, we do really like Virginia so far.
I was originally from Chicago, left the Army in D.C., and came here. So learned a lot about the place. And,
okay.
My original concept of the South has been changed a lot.
Right.
So here is Kyle Watts reading his story, The Lego Master.
Bridget and I lay together in dark silence. From her soft breaths, I knew she was awake too. We contented ourselves to feign sleep rather than face each other. What was I supposed to say? I needed her now more than ever, but I needed to wrap my head around everything first. Earlier that day, we received the news. We could not deny that it was our own fault. We didn't intend it, though. This was an accident, and really bad timing. We knew nothing more could be done but to move forward. The worst part of all was the deadline. No matter what, our lives would change forever in precisely 9 months. The next day, I sat waiting in my unit's admin shop. For the last 2 years, my gorgeous bride and I enjoyed the best that sunny Southern California had to offer. Now, only one stamp remained on my checkout sheet. Then it would be over. Our newlywed adventure was ending, along with my government paycheck and free health care. I considered the DD-214 in my hands. After 4 years in uniform, how could this piece of paper be the only proof of my service to be safeguarded at all costs? It seemed far shorter and less significant than I would have ever anticipated. I attended mandatory transition assistance classes. The facilitators made it sound so easy. All I had to do was make my resume, translate military skills into civilian words, go to the interview, and boom, I should have a job making at least as much as I had in the Marines. I was an officer. I earned a degree. I had 10-point preference. Here I am, corporate America, and you're welcome. Hundreds of unanswered applications later, I took the first civilian job that made me an offer. Bridget and I loaded our car and headed across the country to our new home in Pennsylvania. Her ballooning belly joined us. Our accident revealed its gender. It would be a boy. I would have a son. I understood for the first time I was about to be a father. I mentally skipped the first few years of my son's life and settled on a boy playing Legos at our kitchen table. Wound so tightly around the fantasy, I disregarded any potential difficulty with putting a human on the earth and keeping it alive. That night I spent $120 we didn't have on a VW camper van Lego set. God bless Amazon Prime. The set contained 1,300 pieces and said 16 plus on the box. I didn't care. It was the first Lego set purchased for my son. For 3 days, when not of work, of course, I built the camper van. I took my time. Every brick possessed meaning. Where does the engine sit? Will I be a good dad? How does the roof attach? Can I provide for my family? Even the rear seat folded down into a bed. The intricacies fascinated me. I completed the van and put it back in the box on the shelf for safekeeping. I knew then that somehow everything would be just fine. My son and his mother didn't get off to a great start. The size of his 42-week overbaked head sent the whole birth south. I attended the event as a spectator, watching my wife in agony and the hospital staff try to fix it. There was nothing I could do, and I felt more useless than ever. An emergency operation extracted the baby from his world into ours. They sent my poor, brave wife to something that felt like solitary confinement in the ICU while I stayed with the baby. With Bridget being reassembled, I was his only family around. I removed my shirt and sat down. A nurse handed me my son for the first time, and I held him skin to skin. I breathed him in and called him by name. Hello, Grayson. My name is Daddy. We've been waiting for you. I wondered if I was supposed to feel more than I did. I wondered why all the nurses acted like we weren't allowed to carry our own baby, like they were protecting him from us. Didn't they know we would take him home in just a few days? Wait, we were taking him home in just a few days? We arrived at our apartment alive and together. I set Grayson on our kitchen table in his car seat. Bridget and I looked at each other more confused than ever. He was asleep. Neither of us knew why, but we silently agreed we should never wake a sleeping baby. So, what now? I worked from noon to 10 p.m. each day. By the time I made it home, Bridget had nursed, rocked, and put Grayson down several times. When I arrived, I took over and walked him around my racetrack. Through the kitchen, around the table, past the living room, hard left into the hallway, and a final turn back to the starting line. Lap after lap, I shushed him to sleep. Next came a series of tests. First, the arm test. Pinch your wrist between two fingers and slowly lift the arm out from the body. Once the arm reaches a 90-degree angle, release and pray. If the arm hitting his side caused the body to twitch, I started the racetrack again. If not, I move to step 2, the horizontal test. Sit upright on the edge of the sofa. Very slowly, lean back with baby on chest until lying flat. Now lay still. Did he move? Did his breathing change? If yes, I was screwed and back to the racetrack. If not, I prepared for the final phase, the transition. I hovered over the crib and laid Grayson down on his back. experience taught me the location of every creaky floorboard in the minefield standing between me and the door. Assuming I safely exited the room without setting off the baby bomb, I knew then I simply started his timer. I thought the Marine Corps had taught me the meaning of sleep deprivation. I understood how wrong this was after several months as a new parent. The real definition was 4 to 5 hours of sleep a day, broken into pieces less than 2 hours long for months in a row. This cumulative daily total of sleep included the 45-minute nap all three of us took immediately after breakfast each day before I went to work. We were zombies. Even Grayson looked tired, but the kids simply would not sleep. Every day was the same. Wake, sleep, work, racetrack, try to sleep, wake, repeat. Grayson grew older and I missed every milestone. Nearly every second I had with him, I wished him away to his crib so we could all sleep. I spent my waking hours at work with people I didn't like, doing things that didn't matter, making money that wasn't worth my time. I felt barely connected to my son and couldn't take it anymore. My second job came through much easier than my first. Apparently, a year in a loosely related industry meant far more than 4 years of military service. A new company offered me a job in the Midwest. Bridget and I discussed our options. So, are we moving to Wisconsin? I think we are. That settled the issue. Change was needed, so it was simple. We packed up again and moved across the country. Grayson and I finally began to bond. Saturday mornings were daddy dates. Since Wisconsin weather is horrible 11 months out of the year, our dates were always inside. I took him to a mall with an indoor playground, then we purchased a hot pretzel. After our snack, we walked to the Disney store, then Bass Pro Shops to look at the fish. At 2 years old, I decided Grayson was beyond the eat, choke, die stage with small items. Time to fulfill my Lego fantasy. The Daddy Date Mall contained a Lego store. I took him inside and did my best to impress on him how much he would love them. We picked out a small fire truck set and brought it home. At first, I built the truck myself while he watched. I explained each step in the instructions. When we finished, every time he had the same reaction. Daddy, can we do it again? His desire to build the set with me rather than play with the finished product felt more rewarding every time he asked. I never turned him down. Legos taught me more about my son than I ever knew. I saw his perfectionism every time I put a piece in the wrong place, which personally offended him. His sharp eyes spotted pieces in a pile that I missed 100 times. He eventually decided, of his own accord, he no longer required the instructions. He started building whatever he wanted. His creativity astounded me. Even more astounding was his ability to articulate whatever he wanted me to help accomplish with the pieces. Only so much could be done with a 200-piece fire truck, so I bought him a monster truck and a rocket ship. He received a Spider-Man set for his birthday. Then Lego Batman arrived, and new sets appeared on a weekly basis. The more pieces we added to his collection, the more his imagination exploded. Grayson, you are a true Lego master, I told him. He replied without looking up from his hands or altering his concentration. Yeah, I am. One day I came home from work to find him playing Legos at the kitchen table. Bridget came out of our bedroom holding the VW camper van. Daddy, Grayson was wondering if he could play with your Lego camper van. I told him we would wait until you got home and ask. I almost forgot the van was stashed in our closet, moving with us across the country. At my request, Bridget had wrapped it carefully, surrounded by tissue paper, in a box of its own for the journey. I hesitated. I really didn't want that thing to break. I'd be very careful, Daddy. When had the camper van become mine? I bought it for Grayson before he was even born. Of course he should be able to play with it, but I couldn't let him do it. I just knew he would break it. I don't know, buddy. You've got all your Legos there. Why don't you just keep building with those? Please, Daddy, please. I won't take it apart. I forced my son into begging to play with a toy that I purchased and constructed for him. This was just pathetic. Okay, you can see it, but... I paused, raising a hand to halt his excitement. You have to be very careful, and we can't pull it apart. I'll sit here with you and show you how it works. He jumped back up in his seat, and I began going over the vehicle. The front wheel spun but couldn't turn. The roof came off so you could see inside. A hatch popped open in the back, revealing the engine. Best of all, the rear seat actually folded down into a bed. I watched him fill the van with Lego people and create a world of his own. In my own world, I flashed back to before he was born. I remembered the first time I saw him in my dreams, playing Legos at our kitchen table. It was all here now, right in front of me. With the permission granted, the camper van became a central component of Grayson's Lego world. I'd get home from work and see different characters in the driver's seat or reclined on the bed in back. Additions like mounted weapons or exterior cargo were introduced, but the original van remained intact. After several days, I walked through the door one afternoon and found my family looking worried and somber. Bridget presented me with 2 gallon Ziploc bags. One contained the partially destroyed roof of the camper van. The other was filled with the driver's door, side doors, and tons of other loose red bricks. I learned that while playing, Grayson accidentally rolled the van off the table. "I'm sorry, Daddy." My gut reaction was disappointment and a little anger. These quickly subsided into shame. What the hell was my problem? Why did I care so much about this stupid Lego set? Most important, was I seriously going to guilt my son for not listening to me? I flashed again to my vision of him playing at the table. This time, though, I saw the reality of a week earlier. Everything I had ever hoped for was still right in front of me. "It's okay, buddy. We can rebuild it. Everything will be just fine." Another job, another state, and 1,000 more Lego hours passed. The camper van no longer resembled itself in any recognizable form. On a crisp evening, Bridget and I took Grayson for a walk, along with his 2 sisters added along the way. We passed our neighbors across the street playing in their front yard. The kids immediately synced up, as did the moms. This left me to socialize with the father. As we made our small talk, I overheard my son. "Who is the Lego master in your house?" "My daddy is the Lego master in ours."
John, you're about to read a little bit of your story, The Pit, but give us a little background so we can understand what it is as you read it.
I was a basic trainee at Fort Dix, New Jersey in September of 1970. 5 days after I graduated from Penn State, I got scooped up in the draft. And this is a story about a guy that probably never should have been in the Army and how he just about did end one of our drill instructors on a training field.
All right, go ahead and read The Pit.
"I don't know, but I've been told." Sergeant Lopes's voice rang out in the chill morning air, chanting our favorite Jody as we hiked the 2 miles to the grenade range. "I don't know, but I've been told," echoed the trainees of Delta Company. "Delta Company's mighty bold," Lopes belted out, skipping backward on the road with the practiced ease of a prize fighter as we slogged through deep sand on the berm. "Delta Company's mighty bold," we parroted back with gusto, now more than halfway through the Army basic training course at Fort Dix, New Jersey. Sergeant Lopes, 1st Platoon drill instructor, led the entire company, while another DI brought up the rear, heckling stragglers. The 2 remaining DIs requisitioned a 5-quarter-ton truck to pick up hand grenades from the ammo dump. "Am I right or wrong?" our DI shouted, palms upward, exhorting us to increase the volume to drown out Charlie Company across the road on their way to the rifle range. "Sound off like you've got a pair." "Am I right or wrong?" we roared back. "Company, double time, march." Delta responded to the order, picking up the pace, gear clanking as slung M16s struck full canteens hanging on web belts. 6 weeks ago, as raw recruits, double-timing the final half-mile to the grenade pits in deep sand with full gear would have killed us. Today, we were barely breathing hard when Lopes ordered, "Company, halt!" Reeves's gear arrived before he did, carried by the 2 strongest men in our platoon, petty criminals from Rochester, New York, who chose Army time over jail time. Reeves, our mama's boy, staggered toward the platoon, totally winded, looking for a place to sit. "Thanks for joining us, Private Reeves," quipped Sergeant Lopes, making no attempt to conceal his sarcasm. "Yeah, what the fuck, Reeves? You ought to be in Charlie Company the way you run, you pussy," jeered Martin, a former high school track star. "Can it, Martin?" Lopes said in a voice hard enough to scratch glass. "First platoon, take a knee. Listen up, ladies. I survived 2 combat tours in Nam and do not intend to die today. All you have to do to qualify here is what we have been practicing. Nothing more. Any questions?" "Reeves?" "Okay. Saddle up and move into the blockhouse. Find your name on the platoon list. That's the order you will join me in the pit for qualification. Watch what the man ahead of you does. This ain't rocket science." Reeves, ashen, was clearly scared shitless. Sergeant Lopes was looking at him. He turned and we made eye contact. Then he slowly shook his head. The fine mesh net of the draft indiscriminately scooped up some young men unfit for military service. Guys like Reeves. The list ranked our platoon from best to worst. Reeves was last. The 4 DIs took positions in the grenade pits, oversized foxholes 5 feet deep, 6 feet square, with wooden pallet floors so we didn't stand in ankle-deep mud. Each pit had a case of grenades in the rear corner on the DI's side. "First wave, link up with your DI and wait for further instructions," barked the salty E-8 range officer with tattooed forearms like Popeye. The 4 top trainees in Delta strode confidently down the concrete steps from the elevated blockhouse. The rest of the company watched behind thick, bullet-resistant glass. A 2-foot-tall, 6-foot-deep continuous berm ran in front of the row of pits. Made from the sandy orange clay excavated from the pits, it had been tamped into a hard, smooth, curved surface. As each trainee dropped into a pit, the DI raised his right hand, the ready signal for the range safety officer. When he saw 4 hands in the air, he raised his microphone. "The range is hot. Repeat, the range is hot. Fire when ready." Lopes gave the command, pull pin. Martin, our number one, responded with no hesitation. "Throw." Martin pegged the 1-pound baseball-shaped grenade 40 yards. It bounced once, rolled, then detonated, followed closely by 3 more explosions. The shockwave slapped the reinforced concrete building, followed immediately by a storm of hot metal slivers, pinging as they ricocheted off concrete and glass. Fine orange clay dust hung in the still morning air, slowly dissipating. "Second wave, move out," boomed the E-8. First wave re-entered the building, all smiles and fist bumps. Martin took Reeves by the shoulders and whispered to him, "You can do this. Don't sweat it." Reeves offered Martin a wan smile, not convinced. Never allowed to play outdoors as a kid, Reeves didn't know how to throw a ball when I first coached him on tossing the grenade. He threw like a girl, mostly forearm, a little wrist, no shoulder. His first toss was less than 10 yards. "Reeves, you douche, you just killed yourself and barely scared the enemy," I laughed. He improved somewhat, but I knew live fire would be a challenge. Reeves, hyperventilating, eyes closed as his turn in the pit neared. "Reeves, calm down, man. Just do what we practiced. It's no big deal. I know you can do it." He opened his eyes and gave me a half-hearted smile. When the command, "Next wave," came, he hesitated, afraid to exit the building. I gave him a nudge. "Just do it, man." The 4 trainees in the pits were the dregs of Delta, the worst of the worst. This was where the DIs would earn their money. 3 DIs had hands in the air as Sergeant Lopes spoke with Reeves, hand on his shoulder. Reeves nodded. Lopes raised his hand. "The range is hot. Repeat, the range is hot. Fire when ready." Over the next minute, 3 grenades were lobbed downrange, weakly and inaccurately. All eyes shifted to Reeves and Sergeant Lopes. Lopes repeated the command, "Pull pin," for the 3rd time, before Reeves, now shaking, tentatively removed the pin. "Throw." Reeves turned toward the DI, right arm extended, attempting to hand the live grenade to Sergeant Lopes. Lopes gently returned Reeves into position, then repeated, "Throw." I watched in horror as Reeves crumpled to the floor of the pit, grenade in hand. The grizzled range safety officer's jaw muscles bulged, a vein in his temple throbbing. Jesus H. Christ. Reeves, do not release the grenade. Do you understand? Get on your feet. Reeves managed to roll to his knees as Sergeant Lopes' eyes remained locked on the grenade. Can you stand up? Reeves shook his head. You hold on to that grenade while I help you up, understand? Reeves nodded weakly. Okay, Reeves, let's get rid of that grenade. Sergeant Lopes' voice, smooth as silk, no hint of tension or fear. Throw the grenade, Reeves. Reeves reverted to his girl throw, bouncing the grenade off the berm, a foot above the lip of the pit. Everything shifted into slow motion. Holding my breath, I watched the spoon separate from the grenade, strike the berm, then slide back into the pit. Sergeant Lopes slammed Reeves to the floor of the pit and jumped on top of him as a human shield. Forward momentum carried the grenade slowly up the face of the berm. I silently counted. 1,000. The grenade still rolling toward the crest of the berm. 2,000. The revolution stopped at the apex. 3,000. The grenade appeared to be making up its mind which way to roll, before finally dribbling over the far side of the berm. 4,000. The front of the berm erupted into a geyser of fist-sized chunks of clay as I silently counted. 5,000. The E-8 unleashed an impressive stream of profanity over the loudspeaker. Sergeant Loeb stood up, waving his arms to clear the dust. The range officer shouted, "Get that fucking pussy off my range now. Do you understand?" Reeves lying crumpled like a dish rag on the floor of the pit, inert. The three other DIs from Delta rushed to Loeb's pit, hoisted Reeves out, and carried him to the 5/4-ton truck that had delivered the grenades. Sergeant Loeb inspected the fresh blast crater in the berm to see exactly how close he had come to death minutes earlier. Delta Company silently filed out of the blockhouse, formed up, ready to march back to the barracks. The mood somber. There would be no Jody's chanted on the 2-mile hike. We never saw Reeves again.
John, I've been in that position. I have taken grenade training. Was this personal with you?
I was there, yeah.
Who were you in that story?
I was the person who had attempted to train Reeves in how to throw, and apparently not very successfully, at least as far as what he remembered when he got to the pit and froze. I knew he was going to have trouble. And
as you say, he reverted back to that girl throw.
Yes, he did. Everything I had tried to teach him over the previous month just went out the window. Once he took that grenade and fell to the bottom of that pit, we weren't sure that he hadn't loosened.
Did he know what he had in his hand?
Oh, yeah, he knew what he had in his hand, and I think that's why he was terrified. Not everybody is intended to get into the military, and one of the problems with the draft in 1970, with the Vietnam War still in full swing, was that a lot of these guys that probably never should have been called up for service ended up getting called up. Some draft board somewhere was meeting a quota.
He did not enlist.
No, absolutely not. No.
He's not the kind.
No, Reeves was homeschooled. Only child of a single mother who was overprotective of him, and he was never allowed to play outside.
What became of him?
We have no idea.
I'll bet you had some thoughts about it.
Well,
what you wish had become of him.
One of the things about the DIs was that they were evaluated based on graduation rate, and Reeves was not a guy who was ever going to be able to graduate from basic training. So I don't know whether or not he didn't count against our drill sergeant, who we liked very much and was promotable. We were hoping he'd pick up another stripe at the end of our tour, basic. But now we have no idea what happened to him. I don't remember anybody even asking what happened to him.
John, thank you.
Thank you, Lou.
You've been listening to Voices from the Mighty Pen, produced by Virginia Voice in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial Foundation's Mighty Pen Project. For more information on the Mighty Pen Project, visit vawarmemorial.org/learn. This is Teresa Ray for Virginia Voice.